Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The poet Pablo Neruda once said, "A people are never defeated until the hearts of its women are on the ground." In a new book, a Chinese-American writer shares the life stories of four extraordinary Tibetan women: a freedom fighter, a labor camp survivor, a visionary educator, and a child bride. Each of them endured unspeakable heartbreak in the years following China's takeover of Tibet. But as author Kanyon Sam recounts, their resilience and spirit were never broken. The book is titled Skytrain. Kanyon Sam joins me in the studio. Kanyon, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. We will be opening the phones later on in the program, and please do join us with your comments and your questions for Kanyon Sam on her new book. Kanyon, you are Chinese American. How did you first become interested in Tibet?
In my 20s, I decided that I would fulfill a lifelong ambition and travel to China for a year. But in the beginning of the second month, just in the midst of my travels, I went to Tibet. Tibet had just opened to tourism and to foreigners. Been closed by the Chinese for 30-something years, and then before that, sort of through self-imposed isolation. So there were, just a few dozen mainly backpacking travelers in town. I was taken in by a Tibetan family that I befriended and ended up spending several months in Tibet. And then I went back to China, but eventually found myself living in Dharamsala, and pretty soon my whole year revolved around Tibet instead of China.
And you hadn't been planning, had you, to spend that time in Tibet?
No.
When you first went, it was just for a little trip, as far as I understand.
Right. It was part of, one of a long list of places I wanted to see in China. I was going to travel for a year and then maybe teach English for a year, settle in one place. And I was mostly interested in, traveling through a lot of the Western areas, which are all the minority areas. And so it wasn't part of my plan at all. In fact, I had to, being sort of a planner type, I had to be willing to let go of all my plans and, even though I'd been planning for 2 years.
Tell me a little bit more about the family that took you in and what happened when you first arrived in Tibet, what your first impressions were of that extraordinary country.
For one thing, there was magnificent endless vistas, because we landed in this huge, broad valley or, plain area, and there was no airport. So it was just a tiny plane with about 66 passengers, and I was the only Westerner. It was all sort of these bureaucrats that look sort of like 60-year-old mousy tongues. They're all men, and they're all bureaucrats, and they're all Chinese.
And this was the mid-1980s.
Yeah, this was 86, and it was a little plane, and we just landed, and there was no buildings, there was no airport personnel, there was no signs, and there was this incredible vista, just an endless horizon. The sky was very saturated, beautiful blue. The air was very crisp, and I just remember how different it was than China, because China was very crowded. There was always so many people and so many bikes and so much noise and so much, clutter and crowds. So I just loved the spaciousness and the... And then once we got to town, people, mostly women, would just sort of track me as I went down the street, and they were really friendly. They would stick out their tongue, which meant hello. That sort of means hello. And the older women. And, I was like, these people are so friendly, whereas they weren't very friendly in China. So I really remember thinking, because it was so different and so magnificent and clean, the air and there was mountains surrounding the city. I thought, even though I had only been around in China about 4.5 weeks and not stayed anywhere more than, 4 nights or 5 nights, I decided I'm going to stay a month here. And so I was just sort of minding my own business, and I befriended a Tibetan who spoke a little English, and sort of bumped into her again the next day and had a really great connection. So I ended up living with her family, meeting her mother, and we just got on really well.
And there was no problems for the family having a foreigner live with them in the mid-1980s? That was okay?
At that time, there wasn't, but I now realize it was because I look, well, they all thought I was Tibetan, you know, because I fit in. So nobody questioned, you know, that I was, for instance, in their home quarters, which was only people in their work group.
You call the book Skytrain. Tell me about the train, because you've taken it, reluctantly at first you took it.
Right.
Back to Tibet.
Right.
And you talk about it as a second invasion.
Well, I use that as a title because it, in a way, represents sort of like the 21st century invasion of Tibet. I mean, the military invasion was 59. And but what the train represents now is, in a very big way, since the Chinese came in 1950, that they're going to start extracting billions of dollars, basically, worth of precious minerals. They've already taken billions of dollars worth of the virgin growth trees in the southwest, in the southeast. And so, but the train ostensibly was built to modernize Tibet and help Tibet develop their tourism. But what they found after they built the train was that China had conducted this 7-year-long survey with 1,000 international scientists and found that there was tremendous natural resources in Tibet. And so, you know, billions of dollars, which would shift their foreign dependency on oil and gas and all kinds of, you know, iron ore. And so it meant that now they're already branching off and building 6 branch trains to feed this one. So it means that it allows them, this train, to bring in mining equipment and bring out all this raw material.
It also means, presumably, that the link is much more established,
right,
between China proper and Tibet, that there is,
exactly,
now a permanent established transport link between the two places.
Right. And in a way, you know, it's like the train between across the states, you know. It binds the establishment with the frontier.
You took the train in 2007 to,
right,
Lhasa.
It had been up for about 7 months.
You hadn't been back for some 20 years. What was it like when you first went back in 2007 compared to how it had been in the 1980s?
Well, there was no comparison, really, because so many of the Tibetan buildings were had been demolished and bulldozed. And one thing I really loved about Tibet in 86 was that there were very few people compared to China, which was extremely crowded even then. And so the pace of life was slower. The people were really friendly and open. And in 2007, there were hundreds of thousands of Chinese immigrants and, you know, skyscrapers such that you could barely see the Potala Palace. The Tibetans always had a rule that, you know, nothing could be built above 3 stories, so that you could always use the Potala as a landmark and, you know, orient yourself in the Lhasa Valley, how far you were from the center of town and which direction. But they now have buildings commonly that are 6-8 stories high, so you can't see the Potala. And just so many cars, air pollution, the rivers polluted. The Tibetans are absolutely miserable, you know.
And you could tell that arriving there, that Tibetans, it seemed like a change, not just a changed landscape, but a changed people.
Right, because you could hardly see any Tibetan people. It used to be just Tibetan people. And the Chinese that were there in 86, you really didn't see them. I mean, they were in the telegraph office or the post office or whatever their state-assigned job was. But afterwards, they didn't come out in public. They all hated being there. It was considered like a really odious assignment to be stationed out in Tibet. It was like being put in Siberia. So they stayed in their work housing units, which were attached to their work assignment, work camps. And so they would basically stay indoors and on their weekends and nights off and, you know, socialize amongst themselves.
During the 20 years you'd been away, you'd been compiling a book on Tibet based on the oral histories of women. Why did you choose the women of Tibet to tell the country's story?
I just was actually following a curiosity, because when I lived in Tibet, women were very central to everyday life and to social society, and really, I thought, embodied the liveliness and openness and fun and kindness of the Tibetans. But when I was in Dharamsala, which is in the Tibetan capital in exile in India, I realized that they weren't in the government. They weren't in government offices. They weren't in the literature. Only 2% of the literature was about women. They weren't in the religion. I had a friend who studied the Jataka tales, folk tales about enlightenment in Buddhism, and she sort of systematically studied them over 300 stories, and they were, none of them was of the story of a woman becoming enlightened. Anyway, all these factors. So I decided that, you know, what were the women's experiences? You know, even the literature by Americans and Westerners only showed the men. So I wanted to know how their experiences were different than men. And it wasn't a big publishing venture then. It was just sort of collecting stories.
Kanyon Sam is the author of Skytrain, Tibetan Women on the Edge of History. After this short break, we'll be talking more about the new book and the experiences of Tibetan women. Do join our conversation. 1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. Stay listening. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. You've joined our conversation with Kanyon Sam. Her new book is Skytrain, Tibetan Women on the Edge of History. Kanyon, just before the break, you were telling me why you wanted to look at women in Tibet, and you described this kind of sort of almost bipolar situation where you have women being very central to domestic life and to the society, but actually not included in religion, not included in official government hierarchy. You spoke to, I think, 36 women mm-hmm. and compiled their oral histories and then chose four of their stories. Tell us a little bit about the women whose stories you represent in your book.
Well, I chose women who had known Tibetan society in Tibet before the invasion. I chose sort of the stories I thought were really powerful, representing different aspects of the 50 years. One woman was a child bride, and she was 8.5 months pregnant when the uprising, when the military came in. So we're talking about 40,000 military troops ringing the city with cannons and bringing in heavy artillery to a country that pretty much sat out World War I and II and had no conception of, you know, warfare.
You describe this extraordinary scene of some of the monks trying to hit the tanks as if they were horses, or
yes,
thinking that maybe they would be able to get them out just by hitting at them.
Right, because they'd never seen such, you know, creatures or things. And they had, you know, the Tibetans had been so isolated culturally and diplomatically and politically. So they really couldn't figure out, this child bride, she couldn't figure out what this thing was. And so they took their axes and thought, oh, you know, we'll try to like chop it up, you know. And they had no conception that of what it could do. And so it backed up and it shot them. And she said they stood there and all watched because they never knew what it was. But she ended up having to give birth because she was very pregnant. And outside a town a couple of miles from a hilltop. And therefore, she was able to witness the whole 3 or 4 day bombing. And she had this story where it was a riveting story where she kept saying that she ran to the window because she'd never seen anything like it, you know, bombing and machine gun fire and rocket fire. And she kept watching the whole town, the ashes and the smoke and the explosions. And then she would tear herself away from the window and say, no, it's not good for the baby, you know, and she'd go lay down. So to me, and she'd go back to the window because she had to see what's going to happen. To me, it was something unimaginable. And the only thing we could compare it to would be 9/11. You just couldn't imagine something, you know.
Chokey's story, The Child Bride, is sort of fascinating to me because she'd had this incredible life up until the invasion as well. At 14, her mother was approached and said, right, she has to be married off to somebody who was a provincial governor, is that right? Or somebody in a position of authority, but who had 3 children already who were all older than her.
Right.
But actually turned out to be a nice guy to her. They seemed to have got on well.
Yes, and he ended up being, you know, a high-level cabinet minister, and therefore she was sort of privy to a lot of inside stories, which is why I liked her story because.
But also he left. He left.
Right.
He and she didn't go with him, and I thought that was we were talking about this complicated situation of women in Tibet. Her husband leaves with the cabinet to go into exile.
And she completely understands.
And she completely understands.
It's not like our culture where we would say, you're not leaving me with 6 kids. I'm sorry. You know, I said, what happened to your husband? Well, he was in the Dalai Lama's rear guard. He was part of his entourage. He's part of his cabinet. He has to go with the Dalai Lama. And I was like, well, was there any provisions for you? You know, oh, no, because everything was chaotic. Everything happened at the last moment. But I said, even if are there any provisions for the wives? The kid, no, absolutely not. You know, I even sort of pressed her. I mean, what would happen if you insisted? And she said, well, if a woman insisted on going with the entourage, because he is a monk, she said, well, then that woman would go camp and walk way at the end by herself. You know, but and even the whole time she was, you know, they were bombing and she was in prison. And she said she just worried about His Holiness.
Tell me a little bit about the conditions of her imprisonment, because in a sense, her story, Chokey's story, is similar to some of the other women, too, because the prison experiences and the hard labor experiences are the same for all of these women.
Right. And you hear it over and over again. They were in Thamsig, which is this sort of, you know, self-criticism, but it was just sort of an orchestrated spectacle where the masses, which is the landless people, are attack and accuse the people with wealth or the people who employed people or the aristocracy, and they're physically beaten and they're tortured. And it was all sort of a mock setup because actually in Tibet, most of the people who were quote-unquote staff or household, you know, servants were actually part of the family, you know. So when they would say, do you want to accuse her of abusing you as a, you know, forced labor, they would say no, you know. I mean, they had a different, it's not like how we think of, you know, domestic help. I mean, some of these people had real power in this household staff. They would decide, well, it's time for the oldest daughter to get married now, you know, stuff like that.
And the physical conditions that Chokey suffered in prison were just appalling. And yet her spirit stayed strong.
Yes. And that's true of many of them. For instance, Sonam Chodron, who was a freedom fighter, was in solitary confinement and for about a year or 6 months, I think, 6 months. And they put, you know, heavy plastic on the window so you can't tell if it's day or night. She said you couldn't even tell what color the food was. And they're not let out except every few days to dump their toilet bucket. And there was no furniture. There was no bed. There was no desk, a chair. She had brought a mat from home and a blanket, but after a while, because it was underground and so moldy, they just disintegrated. And I asked her what she did. This is Sonam Chodron, not Mrs. Namsaling. What she did all those months, day and night alone. And she said, I said prayers and I did prostrations.
Sonam had been recruited by the Chinese at the age of 14. She had joined, she was a performer.
Right. She had been taught Chinese and was, she'd been recruited as a performer, sort of became a star, child star opera singer, and spoke Chinese fluently, and was, you know, a very proud, outspoken person. So later she became a, pretty much did intelligence work and underground intelligence and freedom fighting.
How did she go from having been recruited by the Chinese and paid by the Chinese as part of the Tibetan opera group, but by the Chinese, to turning against them and to working as a freedom fighter? What was her story there?
Well, of course she was, her grandparents, she said, and her whole family had always warned, because the Chinese had come in 1904 and 1910 and done a lot of damage. And so her family, she said, and she'd been listening to them growing up, had always talked about, you know, the danger they represented. So when she was 15, was the 59 uprising, when thousands were killed. And she, you know, they didn't clean up the bodies from the streets either.
She gave you a very vivid description of witnessing
there were rivers of blood, rivers of blood in the streets, and bodies strewn like rag dolls all over the streets, and they weren't cleaned up for you know, a week or two. So she was 15, and she after that she became determined. We're gonna get our country back. So after 20 years of, you know, their first occupation and the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward and all that, she started doing intelligence work and fighting for independence.
For all of the four women that you profile in the book, clearly the uprising of 59 was a huge event in their lives. Talk us through what happened in those few days. First of all, you had the national uprising, and then you had the Tibetan women's uprising.
Well, the Chinese first sort of seeped in the 50s, you know, advisors and so forth. Meanwhile, they were building roads in from China to Tibet. And then in 59 was a full-scale military invasion, which they know now that Mao ordered as a violent, decisive military attack. So the Tibetans spontaneously, and they'd been sort of going back and forth, you know, bringing the Dalai Lama to China for a year or several months. And finally, people knew that they were going to physically wanted to capture him. And there was sort of this pretense of come to our army headquarters without anybody or any guards or entourage or anybody and come for dinner and a theater show. So they'd used this before, and then the people were, these influential people had disappeared. So the people spontaneously in Tibet, in Lhasa, fled to the palace and were, you know, several people thick and surrounded the palace to so he wouldn't be able to come out. And that's called the March 10th Uprising. This is the 50th anniversary.
And then a couple of days later, what's known as the Tibetan Women's Uprising took place.
Right. So this was the sort of early curiosity of mine, because they celebrated this March 12th Women's Uprising, but there was nothing in the literature about it. And what it was that, and this was sort of a key finding, was I found out that because most of the men were in the resistance and were off in the countryside, and then scores of them, thousands, had also been taken out of town months before by the Chinese, that when the military came in March 59, Lhasa was a city predominantly of women. So the women got together and had meetings several days in a row and decided to, you know, they petitioned the Indian consulate and they did different actions, but they did this big march on March 12th and went through the streets.
And you write in the book about how they lay down almost like human cobblestones.
Right. That was March 10th. They physically wanted to prevent His Holiness from leaving his palace. And so they vowed that they would lay down in the road, and because they would cover the road with their bodies from his palace, the Norbolinka, to the army headquarters at the river.
Canyon, you write in the book that in a time of crisis, with men it's fight or flight, but with women it's tend and befriend. Explain how that played out in Tibet.
Well, one good example is Sonam Chodron, because what happened to her was that she lost several of her family members, you know, in the struggle. Her husband was, part of demonstrations, so he was beaten repeatedly and died, and also put in prison. Her granddaughter, her son. And so after the second death, she said there were two deaths in 2 months, her husband and her granddaughter. She decided, you know, I'm going to go crazy if I stay in solitary confinement. And so she lobbied to be put in the prison where her daughter was, also as a political prisoner. And there she was in a cell with 12 other women. And she really gained a lot of strength, even though she said we weren't allowed to talk to each other, we weren't allowed to look at each other. The food wasn't fit for human consumption. They kept taking our blood, so we were weak and we were yellow. But she said we had a great camaraderie, you know. And she said we weren't supposed to talk, but, you know, we'd always keep up each other's spirits. Some people read, so I would encourage them to teach the people who didn't read. We studied the Dharma. We practiced the Dharma. She became like the mother of that group. And what they have found in these studies is that fight or flight applies to men, but not to women. And what women do is they take care of the young, they take care of the older people. If they have lost their family group, they recreate it. And so when I spoke to her about this, I asked her if there was any difference of men and women who did, you know, political activism. And she said, well, the women in prison, we were stronger. You know, we gained strength from
each other.
So they would say, you cannot chant slogans. And they would say, you know, you can't do this and you can't do that. And she said, we do it anyway. You know, they tried to torture us, and we put us in the snow for 2 days and stand out there. But they had each other and they would come back to each other.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we're going to open the phones now. Please do join us. 1-800-433-8850 is the number. You can also send us an email to drshow@wmu.org to join my conversation with Canyon Sam. Her book is Skytrain, Tibetan Women on the Edge of History. Let's go to Sandy in Phoenix, Arizona. Sandy, thank you so much for joining The Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, can you hear me all right?
We can hear you.
Okay. I just wanted to comment that my initial reaction to the topic of Tibetan women was Tibetan women. I was stunned. To put it bluntly, I'd never thought of their existence, and I wanted to thank the author for writing about them because it is clearly needed.
Well, thank you very much, Canyon. I think, as Canyon was saying earlier, there is this curious position of Tibetan women, and there still is to some extent, that they are not part of the hierarchy. Was that ever... Do you think in your close ties to Tibet and clearly your love of the country, did that as a woman cause you some disquiet, Canyon? The sort of second-class nature of women in official life?
Well, in official life, that's something different. But because I had, you know, lived there and been around the everyday society and the families, I thought that, like I said, that the women were quite central and very much included, very much part of society. It was only in the literature, in the religious literature, and the government. The government, however, has changed a lot because that was 20 years ago.
Let's go to Sarah in Waldorf, Maryland. Sarah, you've joined the program.
Hi, Cathy. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And I just wanted to thank Ms. Sam for highlighting such an important and difficult issue. I read a wonderful book by J. Martin Troost called Lost on Planet China, set of travel essays, and he spends some time in Tibet, and he talks about these are not his words, but sort of the resettlement or immigration of Chinese nationals into Tibet that has occurred since the train line has been constructed, and the ways in which that is sort of very subtly and sort of insidiously changed Tibetan culture. And I was wondering if the author had any comments or thoughts about that.
Okay, Sarah, thank you very much. Canyon.
Yes. I mean, the Tibetan culture is, you know, it's hard to even find anymore that much in Lhasa. I think it wasn't until I'd been there a few days in 2007 that we went to, you know, we walked around the Potala, and there were the Tibetans doing circumambulation. And then another day we went to a mountain outside on the other side of the river because it was Tibetan New Year. And so then that was the most Tibetans I had seen. Otherwise, the place is pretty much overrun with Chinese, and the culture is totally different.
Canyon Sam is the author of Skytrain, Tibetan Women on the Edge of History. Our number is 1-800-433-8850. We're going to take a quick break. Please do stay listening and join our program after this break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
Now that the Conservative Political Action Conference and the National Tea Party Convention have wrapped up, we talk with journalist David Weigel, who covered both. He writes about the Republican Party and the remaking of the right for the online magazine The Washington Independent. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kaye of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined my conversation with Canyon Sam. Her new book is Skytrain, Tibetan Women on the Edge of History. Canyon, we've spoken about a couple of the women that you profile in the book. There are two more women who feature prominently in the book. I'm sure I'm going to massacre their names in my pronunciation, but I apologize. Mrs. Paljor Kimsa and Mrs. Taring. Tell us a little about them.
Well, Mrs. Paljor Kimsa was a woman who lived outside Lhasa in another town and was married to a wealthy landowner. So he had been in Lhasa and seen the troop build up and rushed back to his hometown and said, because he owns a lot of land, he knew he would be targeted by the communists. So he said, you know, we've got to escape. We don't have any time. He was going to take his two wives, which were sisters, and his two sons. And he said, okay, I'll also stop at the monastery and pick up his best friend, who was a Rinpoche. He was a high-ranking monk. So the Rinpoche sort of delayed him and invited him in for a long, formal tea. Rinpoche is the highest incarnation. So you can't really say, no, I don't have time. The Rinpoche was kind of talking in circles and talking around, and he said, because actually he sat in on my interview with his wife, and this is how I got his side of the story. But he basically said, I didn't understand what he was really saying and why he was delaying me until I was galloping home. And then I understood what he was, because they kind of speak indirectly. that he was saying that he would not travel with women. So he had to decide whether he was going to save his wives or the Rinpoche, his best friend. He ended up taking the two Rinpoches and his oldest son, and then he left behind his Mrs. Paljor Khimsar. So they were in a series of house arrest and slave labor camps, gulags, hard labor camps, for 21 years until he was able to come back.
And they were reunited?
They were. They were reunited. She had been one of the few, though, that had survived that camp. Very brutal conditions. At one point, they only had a tablespoon of flour a day, sampa flour a day,
and then
for 3 years.
And they lived in, when you met them, they were living in Switzerland.
Right, and then this woman who had just been in, labor camps for 21 years, he by then had immigrated. He'd gone from, Tibet to India and then to Switzerland since 66. So he came and retrieved her and took her to the suburbs of Zurich. So I remember one thing she said was, because she said they were starving that whole time. She said, in Tibet we had so much work to do and nothing to eat, and here I have lots to eat and nothing to do.
And she had gone through this extraordinary experience while her husband was living in exile in Switzerland.
Right, and her oldest son.
Did it put stresses between them? Could you sense that between them, or had she forgiven him essentially for leaving her in Tibet?
Well, that's a really good question, because the culture is different, right? So there was another case, Mrs. Namso, where they had six children and they were waiting for a boy, and when they finally had the boy, they were so overjoyed. But the monastery came along and said, he's a Rinpoche, and took him away.
Right.
And so you can't, say anything. So culturally, I think maybe she accepted it differently than we would have, And I think also, according to him, he thought that he would take the Rinpoches near India and then come back, and he would be close to his wives and fight in the resistance. But as soon as they left, or as soon as they got near the Indian border, they started getting bombed, and so he...
Canyon, I've got an email here from Tenzin, who writes to us, I am an American who is ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist nun and often run into people who challenge Tibetan Buddhism's treatment of women. They are shocked to meet a nun and had thought that there were only Buddhist monks. It's great to hear the women paid sincere tribute. Thank you. Do you meet Tibetan women who feel themselves unfairly treated by either Buddhism or by the Tibetan culture, or is that primarily a Western view of things?
I think that's in large part a Western view of things, although the more they have contact with the West, I think their views change. I know that they do. I first got to know Tibetan nuns in 1987, and it was this first international conference on Buddhist nuns. And that was the first time when Buddhist nuns... Tibetan nuns got to see Buddhist nuns in other traditions, and they sort of had this idea, if they can get higher educations, we would like that too. And if they can work outside the nunnery, we would like to do that too. But before, they were quite isolated.
Let's go back to the phones now to Keith in Rochester, New York. Keith, thank you so much for joining the program.
Yes, I'd like to ask, suppose there was a state dinner either in the U.S. or China, and the Chinese president was sitting right there, and President Obama actually raised your book in the air and said, I've been reading this very good book on Tibet, and what do you think if he really elaborated and really went into it? And I'm going to bring in here the freedom movement in Iran that he has been criticized for not backing more fully. But if he really went in right in the presence of that Chinese president saying that this is what has been done to Tibet, and even factoring in that China holds a lot of our debt, and that Obama met the Dalai Lama in a room that is not officially part of the White House for reception purposes, if President Obama were to be that daring and that moving in his speech about what the Chinese invasion has done to the Tibetan people,
right.
What do you think the reaction would be at the higher Chinese circles?
What do you think, Canyon? Could more involvement from the White House actually change the situation for Tibetans?
I think it could, but not maybe directly on the Chinese leadership.
You think they'd have to be more careful or more circumspect in the way that they dealt with the situation? What are you suggesting?
I'm not suggesting anything because I don't really know how the Chinese leadership is influenced. But I think it could definitely help our own standing up for principles and our own human rights stand on that.
At a peace summit in Vancouver recently, the Dalai Lama said that the world will be saved by Western women. You said his comments stunned you. Why?
Well, I think he's always out in front, and this is not known about him, but like, for instance, that international conference on Buddhist nuns that I referred to in 87, he came and did the keynote. You know, that was, and he's always been very forward about women's education. Even then, he said, we should have four nuns go for high ordination, you know. The rest of the religious establishment is a little bit more conservative. But he's always been, he's had the ear people have had his ear, Western women and women in general. So he's very progressive. I remember one time he was here in the States and his translator translated something in English and he tapped the desk and he said, that's not what I said. I said he or she, not he, you know.
You've met him. He wrote, and we should point this out, he did write the foreword for your book.
Yes. I had the, you know, lucky opportunity to meet him in 86 when I lived in Dharamsala. And he was very easy to talk to. And, you know, he laughed at my jokes. What can I say? No.
He's got a real twinkle, hasn't he?
Yes, yes. And because, you know, I realized his English was limited, I ended up kind of, like when I was trying to tell him the roads were corrugated and they weren't paved and they weren't finished yet, you know, from Lhasa to Nepal, I just ended up sort of jiggling in my chair to demonstrate what the whole ride was for 12 hours a day. And he was just roaring in laughter. But at that time, I think he was interested in my having seen Tibet because it had just opened. And
let's go back to the phones now to Katie, who joins us from Greensboro, North Carolina. Katie, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show. Thank you for joining the program.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say thank you for this show. I'm in the car every day, and I listen to it every day on my way to work.
Oh, thank you for calling.
I've really enjoyed this topic today, and I wanted to ask the author, when you wrote this book, to what degree were you writing this book as an activist and hoping for some sort of change to arise, or are you writing it more as an observer with the purpose of sharing the conditions in Tibet today?
Well, you know, I originally wasn't thinking about a book. I was just thinking about collecting oral histories. And then realized once I got some wonderful material, I realized I had to think about publishing it. Otherwise, it was sitting in my drawer. So in that way, I'm just trying to represent what their experiences were and get that factual information out. But I think as far as my going back a couple of years ago on the train and seeing the tremendous changes in the culture there and the loss of the culture, I wanted to talk about that because I don't think that's been discussed in depth in any place.
And you've also written about the degradation of the environment.
Right.
Recently.
Right. Because now there's tremendous air pollution and, you know, water pollution. And the, you know, you read about this open pit mining. Like I said, there's tremendous natural resources and minerals there. But you read about these pits that are five stories high. And the Buddhists never took things out of the ground. They never hunted animals. They never mined. And so now they're being able to extract this, and this is going to cost be very damaging to the land as well.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join the program, please do call 1-800-433-8850. You can send an email to drshow@wamu.org to join my conversation with Kanyon Sam. Her book is SkyTrain, Tibetan Women on the Edge of History. Kanyon, we have several emails on the question of Tibet and China, and we have them from both points of view, and we have phone calls as well, so I'm going to put them to you. One writes to us, what is the history of Tibet and China that leads China to lay claim to Tibet? Was Tibet ever a part of China? That's Hank in Dallas. We also have an email from Christian who writes, the logic is false. There is only a problem when you say Tibet is not part of China. Otherwise, there is no problem. Does the author suggest that Tibet remain in the status with no railroad, no outside access, and a slavery system? So we've got people writing to us from both sides of the argument. I'd like you to address China's claim to Tibet and where you see that that stands.
Well, it can be, if you read the history, it can be interpreted any way, either side. The way I read the history and the way I know the culture is that Tibet was independent. For all, you know, circumstances, it was an independent country, has a totally different language, not related, the written or the spoken language, to China. And at one time, if you go way back in ancient history, actually China was part of Tibet, because Tibetans, before they were Buddhists, were very sort of fierce warriors and had the territory all the way out to present-day Xi'an. But, you know, if you read Mongolian history, what you read is that Genghis Khan, you know, had Tibet as part of his territory, as well as, you know, a huge swath of land. And he always wanted China. So eventually Kublai Khan was able to take China. And the Great Wall is built to keep out the Mongolians. They were always the threat to China. But his descendant, Kublai Khan, was able to take China by taking a Chinese name, taking a Chinese wife, you know, dressing like a Chinese, and therefore China came under the same territory as the rest of the empire, including Tibet.
You come down pretty hard on China in your book. Do you think there is any validity to China's claim on Tibet?
No.
And to the argument that there has been, we have one email, actually it's on Facebook. Sophia writes, the life expectancy in Tibet in 1959 was 37 years old. It's now 67 years old, including women. How do you explain that?
Well, I think this is, I'm often asked this, and I think both sides want to trot out their evidence. But the fact is that the Tibetan culture, even though China says we respect it and we want to preserve it, is really being subsumed to the needs of China's development. You know, China's developing at this sort of hyper-competitive rate, and so they need the oil from Tibet. They needed all those trees. All of it was sent to China. So any concern they have about the culture or respecting the culture is very much secondary to that hunger.
Kanyon, how do you think you've been changed by your relationship with the Tibetan women that you've met?
I think that I have gained a lot of strength, because when you look at what these women went through and what they endured and how they survived, many with a great sense of good humor and lightness and contentment. It sort of makes our little everyday, you know, struggles small. And the endurance. I mean, one person said to me that my own long journey with this project, because it just started as an oral history project, and then had to evolve into a writing and a publishing, you know, journey, mirrored the women's own long struggle, which is that you never knew when it was going to end. So it's taught me a lot about patience and faith, you know, and just taking it every day by day, and keeping a light heart. That's That's what they do, if they're able.
Kanyon Sam is the author of Skytrain, Tibetan Women on the Edge of History, is the name of the book. Kanyon Sam, thank you so much for coming in to join the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. I've been sitting in for Diane. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.